Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Peace does not begin with presidents and prime ministers. It begins with you and me. It must be in our hearts before it can be in our homes. It must be in our homes before it can be in the community. It must be in our communities before it can spread to our country and from the country to the world. The process, however, cannot be reversed. We cannot expect five people in Paris or Geneva or New York to successfully negotiate peace for the world without peace in their own hearts. But what is peace? Where do I find peace? How can I be peace? These are all the questions we will seek to answer on this show, so that no matter our external circumstances, no matter the turbulence of our culture, internally we reside in a place of peace. We will talk with, yes, theologians and philosophers, of course, clergy and religious, but we will also talk with artists, writers, musicians, playwrights, and ordinary folk like you and I. It is none of these today, however, that is the first interview on a place of peace. It is, maybe to your shock, a politician. This is a man who destroyed his political future with a decision to bring peace to our country, and thus lived with peace in his own heart, believing he had done the right thing. That man was Gerald Ford, and that decision was the pardon of Richard Nixon. I interviewed President Ford for a book I wrote called The Daniel Dilemma many years ago. The subject matter was the moral man in the public arena, and President Ford was a chapter in the book. In order to assure accurate quotes, I taped the interview. This is the first time the interview has ever been aired. In it, the former president talks about the greatest religious influences in his life, something he seldom ever talked about, and what were the factors that most influenced his most agonizing political decision, the pardon of Richard Nixon. We began the interview discussing the commencement address he was to deliver to his son Mike's graduation class the following day.
But I talk about the dedication that individuals such as myself have to a spiritual conviction and a willingness to have a faith in God and Jesus Christ, and a recognition at the same time that the things that I believe in, because of my religious training, sometimes have to be moderated in the realism of the life which we all live. I don't think that's a compromise of character. It's a recognition that all of us, including myself, are far from perfect. But if we don't have that light of conviction as to the perfection of the world, we never get any place from the bottom, so to speak. So in my case, that training came from my mother and my stepfather. I barely knew my father, so his impact on my life would be...
Was that very difficult? I mean, when you... It must have been when you saw him suddenly and didn't know it even existed.
It was a very difficult immediate situation, but what it really did was to reaffirm my love, affection for my stepfather, because he was a person who had adopted me and was going through great financial difficulties trying to raise a family of four. And my real father was a person of some affluence, and he was not doing or hadn't done as much as the court said he should have done for a long period of time. So the meeting with him showed the contrast of a person who was really trying to raise a family under most difficult hardships, and meeting with your own blood, a person who was a person of some means but who was not willing to help at a time when I, as one member of the family, needed financial support.
You were making $2 a week, weren't you?
I was making $2 a week working an hour and a half a day at a hash joint. I mean, a eating place, not a hash joint in the sense that they use
it. Around
But my stepfather and mother were very devoted to the church. They weren't zealots, but they brought us up under the influence of the Episcopal Church and went to Sunday school and did all of those things. But it was the daily living in the home that sort of made us devoted to the principles that I think I and my three brothers have lived all their lives.
What did you most admire about your mother and your stepfather?
Well, my mother was a very gregarious person. She was always on the move. I don't think she had an enemy in the world. And she had literally thousands
of
friends.
That's where you get that on the move.
I think I inherited some of her characteristics, but she belonged to many, many organizations, the Garden Club, the DAR, the Woman's City Club, various hospital guilds, anything that was had any relationship to people, she was a part of. And
she loved people.
She loved them regardless of their station in life. She was 70-something when she died, and she had had many illnesses. She had two mastectomies.
Really?
She had diabetes. She had a high blood pressure. But she never wanted a lingering illness and never had one, thank goodness. She always wanted to die in her, with her boots on, she used to say. Well, she literally did. She dropped dead in church.
Is that right?
With a heart attack.
Is that right?
And we looked at her schedule for the next month. She had a date book. And she had luncheons 5 out of 7 days for the next month, and I don't know how many dinners. But she lived a life of real action, but action related to people and trying to help people. So I guess I get some of my relationships with people and my desire to keep moving from her.
How about John Byrne says it's just this tremendous energy. He said he was always telling you, come on now, take it easy, take it easy.
And he said, that's true.
But is that true? Do you think that energy that you just have, enormous physical energy, almost demands you?
I get bored sitting around, and disagreeable too. And I think John's analysis is right that I just can't sit still. And it's true also that he used to give me the devil all the time to slow down and to stop doing things. But I inherited a substantial part of that from my mother. But my stepfather was an equally active person. Neither one of them went to college. My stepfather finished the 8th grade.
Mm.
And my mother, I guess, had 1 year in college, and she wasn't very academically inclined, but that didn't make any difference because they both had this very strong feeling of participation with people, the community. And living in an atmosphere like that, you sort of inherited it, wanted to emulate what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. But you say that's the strongest thing you got from your stepfather, too?
Yes, he was, in his own way, just as active among organizations. He was very active in fraternal organization, the Shrine, the Masonic organizations, the Elks. He was active also in the what they called the it was an organ that's sort of an auxiliary to the local police. Mm-hmm. He believed firmly in the job the police were doing, and he was a part of an organization of non-officers who helped the police with their problem. He eventually was drafted to get into Republican politics, and was never an office holder, but was county chairman and active in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole atmosphere in the home was one of doing things in the community to try and help the community, whether it was in one organization or another.
Was there much talk about religion? Or
I wouldn't say that we talked about religion per se. The family tried to live a spiritual life. Now Mike he hasn't really settled on whether he's going to be one denomination or another.
Really?
At least he's not going to take his degree or get ordained in a particular religion as of now. I understand if he wants to be ordained, if that's the right word, in a particular denomination, he has to take another couple of months, but he's still uncertain as to just what direction.
When he comes out of the seminary, does he come out as a minister?
No, he comes out with a degree
in theology.
But without a designation as to which denomination.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, to ask subjects this, because everybody has such an interesting, different perception. When you think of, how do you perceive God? Do you, I mean, a formal deity, or is he a someone close, or do you see him more as a personal type of thing?
I perceive him not as something formal. It's and yet it's something that I rely on. I couldn't draw a picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to describe it in words. I think it's something inward, and since it is inward, it's very personal to me, and something that I don't and haven't talked about in a public forum. I feel uncomfortable whenever questions are really asked about it, because I haven't sat down and written out precisely.
I don't think anyone is. It's
it would be hard for me, and yet it's a feeling within that is important to me.
Some people, though, are, for instance, I said to Don Shula, are you closer to God the Father, or are you closer to God the Son? Some people feel a great closeness to Christ. He said God the Father, which is interesting. Some people, of course, feel, Mark Hatfield said, Christ, of course. In some way, you have to, in some way, I think, personalize him to have any kind of communication.
I think with my association with Mike, and his dedication to Jesus Christ, today I would feel closer to Jesus Christ than I would God the Father.
Mm-hmm.
It's been sort of an evolutionary transition, and I think Mike's had a big impact in that regard.
Because of his closeness.
That's right.
But originally it would be more God the Father.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Perceived.
But I don't feel that that has significantly changed my my own spiritual feeling, because it is so personal. If I had to give a lecture every day or make a speech on the subject, it would still be difficult to write down in specifics. But it's an inward feeling that has come about because of my association with Mike and Mike's discussions with me and some of the things that we've talked about.
I talked to Al Quee, and he recalled the first time that you ever had the prayer meeting. Do you remember that first meeting, he said everybody at the end of it had tears in their eyes.
I think it was a very emotional gathering, and it was a different group, you know, with Al and Mel and Charlie Goodell and myself. But it came at a time, and it was a circumstance which was important to all four of us. And then when Charlie left, John Rhodes became a part of it, and it's been very...
What do you get from that, do you think?
Again, it's pretty hard to sit down, Peggy, and write out or to say in an articulate way what you get out of it. It's,
I guess it's wrong.
It's not the getting of something. It's the community of feeling with three other people that you feel strongly about, and I think it's reciprocated, that you're just taking 5 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever the time is, to get together, to show your spiritual appreciation and your spiritual hope for the future.
Did it come to mean more to you when you became president, or when you became vice president, and you were going through that really traumatic?
I would say yes, because I knew what they were doing, the other three, in trying to help me, and I responded because with their help it was easier to try and go through those difficult times.
You've always had in fact, I would say at least six people said, well, he never wears his religion on his sleeve, and use those exact phrases. And Bob Teeter was saying that in the election, the moral fervor played, and this new almost religious revival in the United States played an enormous kind of subterranean role in electing Jimmy Carter. And here, you were a man equally religious or more so. But you really, do you feel that you're abusing religion if you talk about it or let it show?
I strongly disagree with those who directly or indirectly try to exploit their religious conviction. And I think we've been fortunate in this country, there's been a minimum of that. It would just be so foreign to my own beliefs for me to try and get up and sell a political audience that they should vote for me because I have certain religious or spiritual convictions. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it. I think it would.
And yet Christ said, go and teach all nations. You're between the fact that he said, share the gift, and the fact you don't want to abuse it.
But there is a difference, I think, in how you do it, or the circumstances that you get involved in the process. I would not hesitate at all to be a Sunday school teacher, as I was for about a year when I first came back from the service before Betty and I were married. I used to teach a Sunday school class at Grace Episcopal Church in Grand Rapids. I think that's a very valid way in which a person can talk about his spiritual beliefs, particularly to young people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I wasn't in politics as an active participant at that time. But to go to a political meeting and use one's convictions in trying to persuade them to vote for you is just foreign to my my beliefs across the board.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into the fact that what religion, as we said, really means to you is living. And what I'm trying to do with each chapter is to examine a particular crisis decision in their lives. What would you say, and I can almost guess what you're going to answer, was the most agonizing decision of your career?
It's probably the pardon of Richard Nixon.
Yeah, that's what I...
That had to be very personal in the sense that nobody else I was the only one who could sign that document.
When did you actually start thinking about the pardon?
I never really gave it any thought until I was preparing for my first press conference. I've forgotten when it came, within a week or so after the time I was sworn in. We had a group of seven or eight people, and the people in the White House staff that were trying to brief me on what the questions might be from the press. And I was somewhat surprised that they thought that a number of those questions would involve what I would do or what I wouldn't do, about the tapes, about Mr. Nixon's status. And sure enough, at that press conference, there were four or five questions out of,
maybe even more.
I've forgotten just exactly how many, but at least the questions were very specific, and just because they were so concerned in the press, I knew the public was inevitably going to be interested. And I could foresee, Peggy, after that press conference, that every press conference I had from then until whatever Mr. Nixon's fate would be in the courts would be dominated by one question or another, probably many. And I just figured that I ought to start thinking as to what, how best I could allocate my time in the job. If I had to spend 25% of my time in the job worrying about legal advice from my counsel, legal advice from the Department of Justice on what ought to be done about Mr. Nixon and his problems, when I should be working 100% of my time on unemployment, on problems of inflation, foreign relations, it just seemed to me that I ought to ask for God's help, which I did, and I have no apologies for it. And I think the reaction I got was that what I did was right, and his help was very helpful. And so I had to get advice on technical aspects of it. But the real decision was predicated on my conviction as to what was in the best interest of the country. And there were conflicts. People, of course, thought that Mr. Nixon was guilty, that he ought to go to trial, and that's a very integral part of our society. On the other hand, I had to look at it from another point of view, which was what was in the best interest of the country as far as the president was concerned. And you had to balance all those conflicting arguments. And I think the prayers that I said and the asking of help, when I came right down to it, were the determining factors.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney, who served as President Ford's chief of staff, talked about the political fallout that resulted from the pardon.
There was no reason at all for him to make that decision to do that, except his own firm conviction that until he'd done that, the nation was never going to be able to get on with its business, that Watergate would dominate everything else. And the prospective trial of the former president, the continual question as to whether he would or wouldn't get a pardon and so forth would so dominate the next 2 years that we couldn't begin to address energy problems, economic problems, foreign policy problems. And again, from his standing in the polls the first week after he was in office, of some 71 or 72% in the Gallup poll and about a 3% negative rating, as a result of the pardon, he dropped sharply down into the 50, 45, 50% range, a very clear price he paid for taking that action. No, we eventually got up during the campaign back up in the mid-50s, probably, remotely. No. And every president's standing falls over time, but that kind of sharp drop off, I think, is unprecedented. But I'd be confident, although I don't know for a fact in this area, that he was well aware of the problem there, that was going to create for him personally. But when he had made the decision, because he thought it was the right thing to do.
President Ford had a quality that I remember vividly. He was a kind man. Interestingly, as I reflected on this, I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal that enumerated the corporal benefits from the spiritual quality of kindness. Let me share with you some of the interesting findings. The title of the article reads, Why Being Kind Helps You Too, Especially Now. It begins by talking about a woman who was widowed after 36 years of marriage. 2 months later, COVID and lockdown arrived. The worst possible scenario for a new widow. Isolation from activities and those who might have been a comfort to her. Instead, all she was doing was fretting about her finances and COVID-19. There were days, she said, she just wished she would die. One day, however, she read about a local blood drive. So she walked to a nearby hospital and donated. Afterward, she said she felt, in quotes, exhilarated. It felt, she said, wonderful to do something useful for someone. I no longer was this nobody with nothing to do except endure a wretched situation. Studies further show that when people are kind, they have lower levels of stress hormones, and their fight or flight calms down. They are less depressed, less lonely, and happier. Not only that, they have better heart health and live longer. They are more popular. They may be physically stronger, and get this, a yet unpublished study finds that the kind person may even be considered better looking. Well, next week, our guest is Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle, a prolific author and speaker on the subject of peace in the home. She is a mother of five. I am Peggy Stanton, hoping you will continue journeying with me in the search for a place of peace. Thank you to our sustaining members, our brand new members, and of course to all of you who have recently renewed your membership. Charles and Laura in Wyandotte, Michigan. Michael and Catherine in Washington, Michigan. Jeff and Barbara in Pike Road, Alabama. John and Laura in Auburn Hills, Michigan. Donna in Essexville, Michigan. You too can renew your membership. You can become a sustaining member or make a one-time gift by going to AveMariaRadio.net or clicking that donate button on the Ave Maria Radio app.